Blog Talk Radio.
Bring me something to drink, will you? Hello and welcome to a March 19, 2009 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. We have a very special guest with us today, that being Patrick Underwood. Mr. Underwood is a former rocket scientist, and he and three other gentlemen in the Paris, California area started what is known as the Paris Smogless Automobile Association back in the early 1970s. And let's see if Mr.
Yeah, I'm on now.
Hello, Mr. Underwood. Welcome to the program.
Okay.
Now, to better acquaint our listening audience with who you are, perhaps you could give us just a little bit of background as far as your career in scientific pursuits.
Well, I guess that goes back a long ways. I don't want to take too much time. But I was raised in a well-educated family. Both of my parents had college degrees. My dad was a civil engineer. My mother was an English teacher. And my dad inclined to take me to different things that were of scientific interest. In fact, I remember sitting at the feet of one of the three, the Alpha, Beta, and Gamma group, discussing the atom bomb in 1938. In any case, I went on to study electrical engineering at Ohio State University and got my degree in 1954. I ended up working for Lockheed in Burbank, California for 35 years. After I took the job in Burbank at Lockheed, I got interested in some kind of a reasonably physically active hobby, and I thought of various things, but I remembered back to the days when I had worked with a under my dad's more or less tutelage, worked with the development of a railroad museum in Worthington, Ohio, called the Ohio Railway Museum. So then I kind of gravitated towards that direction and ultimately became the founder of what's now known as the Orange Empire Railway Museum. When we first started, we were attempting to emulate the industry per se, and we called ourselves the Orange Empire Traction Company. And it was a collection of streetcars, and we basically got a hold of a diesel engine, and we were able to get up and get the cars running. Our organization was incorporated in 1956, and it began actual streetcar operations a year or so later. And
now, when you say you were able to get the streetcars running, you mean that you got a diesel engine for the purpose of generating electricity? Is that it?
That's correct.
Because
we
were
able to buy a diesel engine from the Warwick Railway, which operates in Rhode Island. And we had that diesel engine and its generator, attached generator, shipped by its Branson lines down through the canal into Los Angeles, and then we hauled it out to Paris. And after much effort, we were able to get that engine up and running. It hadn't run for several years, and by extensive tinkering and borrowing automobile batteries and so on, we finally got it cranked over enough to get it to run. And shortly after that, we hooked the trolley wire up, and, well, in fact, we hooked a bug. That is just a cord to a streetcar so it could run back and forth a few feet because we didn't have much track.
Hmm.
But we were able to get those cars up and running, and it went well. The organization went through some metamorphoses. In the meantime, it ran afoul of some IRS regulations over the name because it sounded too industrial. And they insisted that we put some kind of a term in our title that would indicate that it was a nonprofit organization. And so we changed the name slightly to the Orange Empire Trolley Museum. And then after a while, it merged with another organization. It was which itself was an offshoot of what I believe still exists as the Pacific Railroad Society. And that merger then resulted in the inclusion of heavy railroad equipment. We have one operating steam engine and several diesels. The Railroad Museum has gotten to be quite prosperous, really, and it does quite well. It features the Day Out with Thomas, the tank engine type thing. It's been a major fundraiser for it. My direct involvement with the Railroad Museum primarily ended about 1961, primarily because I went on into raising a family. I got married and raised a family and stayed with that. However, about 1970, I began talking up the idea of doing this hydrogen car thing, which we then went on and did. And we got together, four of us, and we were able to put together a prototype and ran an automobile on pure hydrogen and oxygen. No other material was used, and actually demonstrated it before the Air Resources Board in Sacramento to show that the exhaust product was water and only water. And I actually let the prototype vehicle drive around the central block in Paris and collected the water in a glass and drank it before the Air Resources Board people.
But
then we went on and developed a better version, which we ultimately ran on cryogens. We were able to receive free supplies of liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen from the Linde Division of Union Carbide, no longer in existence. The successor to Linde Division of Union Carbide, I believe, is Praxair, which is a major industrial gas supply operation today, welding and other purposes. So that cut it pretty short, but that was the basic development cycle that we went through.
Okay, now putting this in its historical context for the sake of people who think that any effort along these lines would be for monetary reasons, we have to remember that in 1970 the price of gas was still pretty low and that there had not yet occurred the Arab oil embargo. So
that's
what was your
correct.
The motivation of your group then, if it wasn't...
Motivation was primarily air quality. We weren't concerned, and we're still... I'm personally still not concerned with the energy situation. But we were concerned with air quality. And it's interesting
that
the year or so following our work was established in the federal government, the Environmental Protection Agency. But, no, our work was just primarily the dream, so to speak, of having an automobile fueling system which would not produce smog elements, primarily oxides of nitrogen and the some of the hydrocarbon results. But that was our primary reason. We were just interested in bettering the environment as such, and while we entertained the thought that perhaps we would get wealthy enough to be able to sponsor continuing research in the area, we weren't basically much interested in personal wealth, although it certainly would have been nice. It would have enabled us to continue. We weren't able to continue, primarily because we ran out of money.
Yes. Now, you did attempt to participate.
First time in my life I've done that either. So.
Yeah, many of us are experiencing similar fate at this time. When you say we, how about the other members of the group?
We involved, in alphabetical order, my good friend Paul Degas, who's still living in Paris, California. He's a civil engineer there and runs his own shop. And then Ben Menig, Dwight Benton Menig, was one of the stronger parties of it and the one that gave me probably the most encouragement of all to continue with it. And then we...
Now, what was his occupation at that time?
At that time, he was the owner of the Paris Progress newspaper in Paris. And much of the work was done in the newspaper office and in his facilities. Although we did a lot of work out in the wilds, too. The early work was done out in the mountainous area, or hilly area, where there were some big boulders we could hide behind and things like that. And then
this is rather humorous. You say that you would actually hide behind large granite boulders.
Yes,
while doing your research.
You know what might happen. We thought maybe we might detonate the engine or something.
Okay.
So, in other words,
you had experience with rocket fuel, correct?
I had no direct experience with rocket fuel, but I had direct experience with a rocket scientist that Lockheed had hired from Germany, so I knew my way around the chemical reactions involved in rocket fuel. So some of that information kind of led me along a long mental trail to reach the conclusion that, well, perhaps hydrogen and oxygen would be a good propulsion system. But that was my industrial exposure there.
But you mentioned the other day that there are two kinds of explosive reaction, one of which is much milder than the other.
Yeah, well, milder is a valid term, although it's very relative, because A deflagration is the kind of explosion you get when things like TNT and dynamite and things of that sort that are set off as explosives. Then there is a class of explosive which produces what's called a detonation. And detonations can occur in ordinary explosives, but generally don't. The nuclear bomb is a detonation, among other things. So detonations are just a stronger explosion. The only, as far as I know, the operational difference between a deflagration, the weaker of the two phenomena, and the detonation, the stronger of the two phenomena, is in the speed of the reaction. In the case of a deflagration, the speed of sound exceeds the velocity of propagation of the explosion. In a detonation, the velocity of propagation of the explosive reaction proceeds at a more rapid rate than the speed of sound, and that's why it's called a detonation.
So if you're igniting hydrogen in air, you get a detonation?
Not ordinarily. It's very difficult to produce a detonation with hydrogen.
Okay, so you get a deflagration.
It's been done. It's a stoichiometric mixture of hydrogen and oxygen, but it's very difficult to develop a detonation, although it does happen. We had one occur accidentally in the exhaust system of one of our early experiments. We have basically three stages in our experimentation. The first experiments, which started in about 1970, were done in about a 1948 Studebaker that we had acquired. It had a shot transmission, and so we towed it into place, but the engine was running. So we were able to run the engine on gasoline and get it trimmed up so it was running well. And then we simply removed the gasoline supply and started introducing hydrogen and oxygen in the area of the intake in order to see if the engine would even run on those combinations. And it took
so
us
you basically you stuck hoses down inside the carburetor, is that it, or what?
We just ran pipes down into the intake, and the idea being that we would flood the intake with the gases. We didn't attempt to seal it off or anything of that sort. We just wanted to see whether the stuff would even burn out if they'd run the engine. And it did, of course, but it took us a while. I think the first day we didn't succeed in getting any kind of reaction, and we didn't even get a puff out of it. And we were puzzled, but we also realized that we were engaging in the study of gas dynamics that was well beyond our inherent knowledge base. I was an electrical engineer, of course, and my friend Paul Degas was a civil engineer. Ben Minnick was a paleontologist. And Fred Nardisha, the third member of our party alphabetically, was an electrical engineer. So we had three engineers and one paleontologist who had taken up the technical job himself. He worked in the MIT radiation laboratory, the old rad lab, that did so much of the heavy research during and after the Second World War. And so he had gravitated that. Paleontologists don't basically make any money unless they're in the academic world. So he had majored in paleontology because he went to Harvard. And Harvard is not a trade school. They don't teach anything useful in the undergraduate program. You're expected to go on into some other field, like a professional field as law or business or engineering or something of that sort in some other institution, or possibly in the Harvard graduate schools themselves. And of course, he could have gone on into academic work and taught paleontology or actually performed some of it, which probably would have been required at the PhD level. But he didn't want to proceed with that. He enjoyed technology. He was an old line railroad fan. He had learned to ride and appreciate streetcars younger. He was 6 years older than I was, so he had the opportunity to see and ride many of the interurban systems in the United States before they went out of business.
And before we move on from that, you commented to me that you felt that the going out of business of the electric streetcar was one of the great tragedies in the history of this country.
Well, I think it was very unfortunate that they went out, but I also understand why they went away. I had a colleague in the historical contemplative organizations of the street railway genre of interest by the name of Lawrence Russ Vesey, V-E-Y-S-E-Y, who was very learned. He was a good student. He became a PhD eventually and ended up being a professor up at the University of California, I think at Santa Clara, but I'm not sure where it was. And he's since deceased. But he had a thesis where he wrote it up as an electric railway hobbyist, an explanation of the demise of the electric railway. And the story basically was based upon the premature death of Henry Ford. And he then proceeded to write what would have happened if Henry Ford had not developed a production line and the rubber tire hadn't been invented. So he proceeded to write up a description of the world as if the automobile never existed. It's a rather interesting line. I never actually read it. He just talked to me about it, and I think he published it after he talked to me about it. And it probably appears in the arcane literature of the Electric Railway contemplative societies and so on, but I haven't actually read the book myself.
So what was the scenario that he painted then?
Well, he painted that the streetcar systems developed to a great extent and, among other things, metamorphosed into an operation where individuals could own their own streetcar and drive in to work on the tracks and do stuff like that.
Instead of using fossil fuel to get around, you're using electricity?
I was using electricity, but of course, most of the electricity in this country today is generated from so-called fossil fuels. By the way, I don't think they're fossil fuels, but that's beside the point. In the early days, it was almost entirely coal-fired operations, and those are essentially fossil fuels, but I'm not convinced that petroleum is a fossil fuel.
Yeah. That's another issue. Carbon fuel, then.
Yeah, hydrocarbon fuel, and that whatever, supposedly depleting resources. Now, I'm not even sure they're being depleted. But that's another issue altogether. In any case, our interest was predominantly trying to solve the air quality problem. The smog situation in California had become especially severe in the 50s. And I think that's what motivated us to look at this alternative. Otherwise, I don't think we would have pursued it. But as far as I think it's unfortunate that we don't have the streetcar systems that we had in those days, but I also understand why they went away.
Yeah, we were talking about
a rather interesting highlight in my life was to have acquired a rather large collection of discarded engineering materials from the Pacific Electric Railway, which used to run through Southern California quite a bit. And they did a study in 1924 that showed a decline in ridership of the railway on the five strongest lines they had. All five of them were declining in ridership anywhere from about 35% to 65% loss in about the 5 years leading up to 1924, in which they were basically forecasting this isn't working. Now, the Pacific Electric Railway had developed real estate in Southern California. We see many evidence of that in city names like Huntington Beach and Huntington Park and Huntington Drive, and then in the San Fernando Valley, Sherman Way. These are all based upon the founders and the operators of the Pacific Electric Railway. The Huntington Library in San Marino, California, was developed by Henry Huntington, who was a nephew of Cyrus P. Huntington, one of the original builders of the Central Pacific Railway. And his whole fortune was based upon the Los Angeles streetcar system. That whole library and everything else all came out of the basically 3-cent fares of the Los Angeles railway system. So there was a lot of history that came through the streetcar system. However, with the development of the automobile, I think that's probably what laid waste to the streetcar systems. And then, of course, the development of the transit bus, internal combustion transit bus, became very common. There were some electric lines running. There are still a few in this country, electric buses, but for the most part, they were so-called fossil fuel operated.
And yeah, of course, GM lost an antitrust lawsuit for deliberately shutting down the system as well.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about the Sherman Antitrust Act, it was basically designed to break up the Standard Oil Company. And sure, they broke Standard Oil Company up into about 8 different pieces, all of which became very strong and operated in a under the Sherman Antitrust Act. But the Sherman Antitrust Act also was very strong in breaking up the electric railway systems, especially the interurbans. They went after Sam Imsel and gave him a hard time, and basically led to the more rapid breakup of the interurban system in the United States. There's a very excellent history of the electric railways in America by Professor Hilton of UCLA, and he wrote quite a bit of this up. It's an interesting story about how that whole industry went down very quickly. The interurban industry began about 1890, and it was essentially gone by 1940. In other words, it had a 50-year existence. And during which time, it, in many places, it thrived and provided excellent service. But it was also broken up under the Sherman Antitrust Act enforcement agencies. So they cut across the whole spectrum. So I don't, I'm not very sympathetic to a conspiracy theory that the internal combustion process, fuel supplies, and bus manufacturing organizations had as direct a causative effect on the decline of the street railway as the general cost of the street railway. They are costly to operate. The tracks are expensive to install and maintain. The crews were fairly expensive. When streetcars were first developed, they were almost all two-man crews. They had a conductor and a motorman that ran the car. Well, then eventually, as they got smaller, they tended to go to one-man cars, and the regulations were very severe. The development of the Pacific Electric Railway in Southern California was marvelous. It was the biggest single organization of its source in the world, of its type in the world. And it was it began to fail as early as 1934 or something like that, when they had their first abandonment, I think, on local lines in Long Beach. But I think the automobile is fundamentally a better operation in many ways. For one thing, it does not have nearly the schedule constraints that the streetcar systems had. It did not have strikes. It was readily available. And from an engineering and energy point of view, they're not that inefficient. So I think it was more or less natural that the automobile would supplant the streetcar systems or the public transportation systems in general. I acknowledge that they are having a renaissance of sorts, but I think it's highly artificial. Now, again, I enjoyed riding streetcars. I have an emotional attachment to them and the whole concept of them, but I just feel that it probably was a good thing that we had them in this country. It allowed workers to get to work and live where they wanted to live and do things of that sort, but I believe that the actual viability of streetcars has probably passed. In fact, I think the general viability of public transportation is definitely weak. I think it's supported by artificial means more than by actual requirements. And, of course, our traffic jams are still a symptom of the fact that the people are willing to put up with traffic jams. I don't like them myself. I avoid them.
Yeah.
But the public transportation systems still don't rise to the occasion of the passenger car. The passenger car is still the fastest way to get around. There's no question about it. And economically, it's much more expensive, of course. But I could not do the things that I do with my passenger car that with streetcars I would love to have been able to do, because the system has gone down. But I can imagine trying to get from where I live in Sylmar downtown Los Angeles by public transportation takes about an hour, and I can drive it in 30 minutes.
Yeah. And that brings us back to
when I want to go, or as we have a headway here of about 30 minutes or so. So I have a 30-minute headway and probably have a 10-minute transfer time. And I love it. I mean, I've been downtown a few times on Metrolink, but it's not even practical for me to drive ride public transportation to the Metrolink station. It's much easier to drive it.
Right. Which brings us back to the subject of, finding a clean fuel for our automobiles.
Yeah, that was the primary motivation. I'm sorry I've digressed as much as I have, but that was our primary motivation. And we did a lot of contemplation about this as we worked to produce our three stages of operation. The first where we merely got the engine to run at all. And then once we realized it could run, we said, well, let's go approach it from a different direction. And so then we did the Model A Ford, where we went into the hydrogen recirculation process, which allowed us to get the engine to run effectively. And we drove that Model A with compressed gas, hydrogen, and oxygen about 100 miles and gathered a fair amount of data on it.
Now, when you mentioned recirculation, perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Okay, I'll elaborate on the circulation issue. The problem that we faced was that it's very difficult to operate a hydrogen and oxygen engine under stoichiometric or exact chemical reactions to produce nothing but water. The upshot of it is that we decided that we could get better performance by running either rich in oxygen or rich in hydrogen and control the other substance. Well, we ended up finding that the practical solution was to basically operate the engine as if it were in a chamber full of hydrogen and only admit a little bit of oxygen into the engine, kind of reversing the process of the normal automobile where the air is introduced freely and the fuel is controlled. In this case, the oxidizer is air and the fuel is gasoline, whereas we reversed the situation and replaced the atmosphere with hydrogen and then used oxygen and metered it. So we reversed the fuel oxidizer role in the engine and we were able to get stable operation. We were able to get it so that with the Model A, we could drive it with two drivers. That is, there was a person steering and clutching and, operating the engine per se, and the other person is controlling the fuel flow because we were just beginning to develop the technology. And as I say, we did run about 100 miles with the Model A. We documented this, and we did, gather some information about the amount of fuel we used and the amount of gasoline we would convert, go back and forth between gasoline and hydrogen to test different concepts. And
now, when you say you documented this, just to interrupt briefly, was there any news coverage, like on the TV, or was this...
There was a little bit of news coverage. Now, we were not attempting to operate in secrecy or anything of that sort. In some ways, we might have gotten more attention if we had. But we did have press coverage by the Press Enterprise in Riverside and a little bit of other news. Some reporters came out and looked at us and talked to us. I think there were a couple articles in the Times. I don't remember for sure, but we did have some publicity.
So you mean the Los Angeles Times?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Los Angeles Times, of course.
Yeah.
But I don't remember exactly what we had. Mr. Degas might be able to answer some of those questions. I don't know how much he might have collected. I didn't say that stuff, if there was any. We did publish, after we did our work, we published an article in Industrial Research, which is or was a magazine involved in that title subject. And then I had a formal paper that I presented under the aegis of the Society of Automobile Engineers in about 1972 or 3. I made a presentation to the what was called the IECEC, it's an awkward name, but it has to do with International Conference on Energy Conversions. And there was a part of the presentation at a big convention in Boston where I made a speech before a group of people that described what we were doing, and I had a rapt audience in that situation. That was a very special audience, of course. We did try to do the Clean Air Car Race in 1971 and failed for various legal and logistic problems. But so
now, when you're referring to this car, clean car race, this was a MIT sponsored race.
This was sponsored jointly by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. MIT is in Boston and or nearby, and Caltech is in Pasadena. And so those two schools got together to sponsor the 1971 Clean Air Car Race, which was to run cars that had various kinds of environmentally clean combustion systems, not necessarily excluding gasoline, but these cars were to run from Boston to Pasadena, California. A rather major undertaking, but we did undertake to do that, and then it was shot down by the lawyers, in essence. I understand why it was terminated. I have no hard feelings against anybody that was involved in that. It was simply a decision made by a corporation that decided it was too risky, and they did not want adverse publicity.
Did you feel that it was too risky yourself?
No. No, I was... I'm fundamentally a very optimistic person, which has gotten me in trouble on several occasions. But in this case, it didn't cause me any personal trouble.
But would you refer to this then as the, what is known as the Hindenburg mentality?
Well, there was Hindenburg mentality. It didn't bother me any because I'm pretty much aware of what happened to the Hindenburg. I honestly believe it was sabotage. But beside that, we actually participated in the early formation of an organization called the Hindenburg Society, which was originally established to promote the use of hydrogen for whatever purposes, primarily automobile transportation. I still believe in it. I honestly believe that a hydrogen-fueled automobile, whether it's a internal combustion engine or a fuel cell or whatever else, is a better solution to the automobile transportation issues than gasoline and air. But so far, neither one has proved its worth economically. The fuel cells are still tremendously expensive, although I think eventually they may find a fuel bed system that won't be so terribly precious. In the meantime, the internal combustion engine could be used, and we could operate the so-called hydrogen economy on the internal combustion engine, but using hydrogen and oxygen. And that's a bone of contention right there. The fact of the matter is that the handling of the liquid oxygen or some onboard storage of oxygen is even more risky than the hydrogen gas itself or the liquid. And there are some processes, nascent processes today, which involve the concentration of oxygen from the atmosphere. And it could be done on board. In other words, it could suck in air, throw away the nitrogen, and deliver the oxygen to the engine. If those systems came along, it would allow us to do that without having to transport the oxygen. But our experiments were done by transporting the oxygen with the idea that if we can get the mechanical system to work, then we can approach the fuel supply situation and perhaps eliminate the requirement for carrying the oxygen. But I do not have much encouragement for the use of air with hydrogen because of the production of oxides of nitrogen. And I haven't seen an exception yet to situations involving air as the oxidizer. I know that natural gas is touted as a clean fuel, and it is relatively clean, but it's relatively clean by virtue of the fact that the engine performance has been degraded to prevent the occurrence of oxides of nitrogen. And if a natural gas engine is run at good performance and efficiency levels, then oxides of nitrogen will be produced and they have to be dealt with. And that's, of course, been the approach, has been to provide catalytic converters or processes to avoid the production of oxides of nitrogen at the loss of energy efficiency, engine energy efficiency.
Yes. Now, as you were going about your research, which apparently the four of you did some extensive research to prepare for this project, you came across?
We did very little research. In fact, if we had done an academic research, we probably would have washed our hands of the whole project. Because the history simply stated that, well, you cannot run an internal combustion engine stoichiometrically. Not that we had, we didn't know this. I mean, we didn't find this adverse information out until after we had succeeded in running the engine. So that's where that goes.
But the research that you did do, you uncovered some patents, and you mentioned
We did decide that we should file a patent application. Our reasons for filing for the patent application were that we felt that if we tied down the technology, then income could be generated through the revenues that might accrue from the patents themselves. And so we began the prosecution of the patents, which ultimately cost us about $15,000 by the time we got done with it.
For how many patents?
Who?
How many patents?
I overstated it. It cost me personally $15,000 to go through the whole project. The patent expenses were fairly high, but probably not over half of that. So I think I misstated myself to say $15,000 for the patents. No, we intended to develop a revenue flow by virtue of royalties from the patents, if we could achieve them, in order to pursue more deliberate research. We were poverty struck in trying to do this. I was spending my own family income to do this, and so was Mr. Degas. And Ben Minnick supplied facilities, which probably weren't as costly to him as some of us were, the others of us were, but we were spending an awful lot of money doing all this stuff.
Yeah, well, there are many people doing similar research out of their own pocket right now. And despite the fact that the government is earmarking billions of dollars for alternative energy research, none of it is going to these individuals working out of their garages and so on.
Well, I wouldn't expect them to now because there's no bureaucracy involved to speak of. In other words,
wouldn't it have been nice if you had had some money to pursue this on a more professional level instead of...
I would love to have had enough money to set up a laboratory. In fact, after we wound down all the active work, we submitted a proposal to the federal government to do a broad investigation of all the different kinds of combustion systems that might be applicable to automobiles using hydrogen and or oxygen or other substances for that matter. And so we proposed to do some broad spectrum efficiency feasibility studies and that sort of thing, set up a laboratory very much like Edison's laboratory, where we would basically attempt to standardize the data from all the different combustion processes that seem to be appropriate. It's interesting that when the gasoline engine was developed, the first internal combustion fuel was gunpowder. Well, not that we would necessarily spend much time doing a gunpowder engine, although I have seen a gunpowder engine, and therefore they probably could be resurrected and used for that purpose. We were basically proposing to document across the entire spectrum of internal combustion engines, the different processes and their combustion efficiencies, energy consumption requirements, and things of that sort. We didn't win the contract, although we did get excellent readings on many aspects of it. We got the highest score for the technology proposal, but we were very weak in economic support. We just did not have our own economic support. The government was willing to put several million dollars into it, but we did not receive an award on that contract. We spent a lot of time putting the proposal together, and it was very well received, but primarily rejected because we didn't have a financial background. They were talking about awarding a contract of several million dollars, and our combined income at that time was probably not much over $50,000 a year.
Right.
So we had no... we had no financial support, and nor was there anything apparently forthcoming. We did have an angel that watched over us for quite a while during the early days of the experimenting, he came out of William Escher, who operated an organization called Escher Technologies, operating out of a town in Michigan. And I've lost touch with William Escher, but he made many, many viable contacts with us and is the one that encouraged us to go to the Boston convention, the IECEC thing.
Now, I'm looking at a paper that came out in November 1972, The Hydrogen Fuel Economy, an Early Retrospective by Lawrence W. Jones of the University of Michigan.
Vaguely remember that one.
Is that somehow related to Mr. Escher? Or?
You might find something about Mr. Escher in it. I don't remember the specific document.
Well, although
I did hear about it.
When you do a Google search of the Paris Small Glass Automobile Association, this paper comes up.
Oh, it does? Okay, well, I haven't talked to Paul about it. I guess I should. Or else I've forgotten about it. That's possible.
I just printed it up this morning. It's a pretty interesting document. It's about 30 pages long.
Yeah, I think I've read it, but I'm not even certain right now. Now, William Escher wrote a very nice paper that was commendatory of our process. It was, I forget what the title he used, but it was basically a completely closed system where we carried the liquid oxygen, the liquid hydrogen, and stored the water inside a completely closed chamber with two electrical connections on it. Primary electrical connections, which would then run motors to do the job of moving an automobile. And it was a completely closed system. Basically, you would drive up to a refueling station and drain the water and accumulate the hydrogen and oxygen in this chamber and then drive off with it. It was a rather interesting, slightly facetious article, but I thought it was very good. It was very commemorative of our activity. But I do have a copy of that around somewhere. I forget. Well, he had a rather clever title for it, too. But it was the theory of that particular publication was that it could show that this was a completely closed system that in terms of air quality.
Yes. So you didn't have any tailpipe pollution.
There was nothing going outside. Everything was done inside this enclosed chamber, which enclosed the fuel supply storage, the exhaust water storage, and the engine operating system itself and the generator, and then had only an electrical header that brought the power out. Now, that was a very accurate description of what could have happened, although we never got to that stage. I know I was proposing to put the engine in a chamber full of hydrogen, and my friend Ben Minnick inveighed against it. He thought it was too dangerous. Well, we didn't pursue that issue. I was just going to build up a chamber out of plastic film and just flood the whole chamber with hydrogen. And have the only thing would be to introduce the oxygen into the intake. But he was afraid the oxygen would build up and we'd have a deflagration at least. So we never did that.
Yeah,
that would have been behind rocks, I tell you that much for sure.
Now, you did comment to me that you were hiding behind a boulder when you had an exhaust pipe full of stoichiometric gases explode.
Well, we presume it was stoichiometric, and we did achieve a detonation. And we were so close to it that our ears shut down. It's amazing. It just sounded like a click. But then we had all this rumbling that went on. It was like standing in the middle of the lightning bolt. I've heard of that happening. People that stand very close to lightning, they don't hear it. They just hear this click. Well, that's the ears shutting down. And
now, people living throughout the valley called the nearby Air Force Base and asked if it was a sonic boom. Is that right?
Right, right. Well, March Air Force Base is right there near, that's right there between Paris and Riverside. It's now called March Air Reserve Base.
Yeah, it's actually a commercial airport now.
Is it now? Uh-huh.
Yeah, for cargo. Now, when you mentioned the patents, there's more than one. Apparently, you divided up the patents. You got one and the others.
Yes. I don't remember what the distinction was. I claimed the advantage of recirculating the hydrogen. And I think Mr. Degas has a claim that involves condensing the water. I don't honestly remember what his claims were.
Do you remember your patent number?
Yes. My patent number is 3862624.
3862624.
Yes.
Okay, so a listener, if they want to look that up, just type that in on Google, and you can get a U.S.
right.
patent to come up on the screen.
I was a long time confused between whether it was 6-2 or 2-6, but I believe it's 6-2. It was. It could conceivably be 3-8-2-6-2-6-4, but I'm pretty sure it's my original number is correct. 3-8-6-2-6-2-4.
Now, did you also come up with this oxyburator, or is that already in existence?
No, we generated that term because, as I say, we were turning the combustion cycle inside out and basically controlling and metering the oxidizer rather than controlling and metering the fuel supply. The carburetor basically meters fuel into the airflow, and what we were doing was metering oxygen into the hydrogen flow.
Yes.
And so we
called oxyburator became your...
We use the expression oxyburator because it's parallel to a carburetor. Carburetor is a short term for hydrocarbon fuel burator. Burator is a chemical device used in chemical labs to meter out substances. A burette, B-U-R-E-T-T-E, was frequently used, oftentimes as a vertical glass tube where you can see the content with a valve at the bottom, and you could open the valve and admit the flow of something into a mixture to produce a chemical reaction. And so that's where the word carburetor came from, because it was buretting carbon fuel into the oxygen or into the air mixture. And so it was a carburetor. And so we said, well, since we're turning it inside out, we'll call it an oxyburetor.
Now, you mentioned a couple interesting aspects of science that you felt applied to pursuing this even further. For instance, you mentioned that the molecules of H2 and O2, you said that the efficiency of using these as a fuel...
The efficiency of an internal combustion engine is an equation involving an exponent of some quantity, and that exponent involves itself the ratio of the number of atoms per molecule in the gaseous mixture in undergoing the thermodynamic cycle. And the lower that number, the more efficient the engine is. So it would be ideal, of course, if you could run an engine on a combustion process between the noble gases. Of course, that doesn't exist. The noble gases are always monatomic. And so, unfortunately, you don't get combustion in a process like that. But if you did, you'd have a very good ratio. The ratio is a fraction, by the way, and I don't remember the exact structure of it. I wish I could tell you right now what it is. But in any case, the lower the number of atoms per molecule of the gas in this engine, the higher the efficiency. And it's called the K factor among people that are, it's an arcane study, and as far as I'm concerned, it's arcane in the area of thermodynamics, and in particular engine combustion processes, or combustion processes in general. They don't necessarily have to be running engines. But if you're trying to extract energy from the mechanical combustion process, then those equations become important. And I could refer those. They do show up, among other things, in Mark's engineering handbook and in thermodynamic textbooks. I don't have either of those handy right now, but they do. Those equations do show up. And this is modern research that probably has occurred in the last 60 years, although I don't know, because it's amazing how much of this research was done very early on. The early days of combustion engines of any sort, or combustion processes, even external combustion engines, steam engines, stuff like that, were well understood by 1800, when Thady Carnot came up with the thermodynamic equations of the efficiency of combustion engines, or engines in general, not necessarily internal combustion, external combustion engines too, steam engines in other words, and turbines for that matter. So the Carnot equations are validated today, but this is an extension of the Carnot equations in the sense that it shows an efficiency term which finally got broken down into this basic term and an exponent, and the exponent contains this thing called K, which is the ratio of the number of atoms per molecule on average in the combustion chamber, in the expansion chamber, assuming that they're expanding the gas to produce energy. Or if you're interested in compressing gases, the same thing applies to the efficiency of a compressor, which goes the other way, of course. You put energy into the gas, whereas internal combustion engines are basically extracting energy from the gas, except, of course, during the compression cycle. So that's a very narrow branch of the study of thermodynamics, and I don't claim to know a whole lot about thermodynamics. Now, one of the other scientific things that intrigued me was the prospect, ultimately, of nuclear-powered water splitting, where the nuclear reactor would provide the energy input to maintain a water-splitting chamber at about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. At 3,000 degrees Kelvin, the water is broken down into its constituents. That is, it's got atoms of hydrogen and atoms of oxygen all mixed at 3,000 degrees Celsius. But if that if that gas is put through a magnetic field, it splits. The flow goes one way for the hydrogen and another way for the oxygen. And it's relative. It isn't all perfect, as far as I know. But then once the products can be separated grossly, then the other elements can be removed by letting it react and the water taken out or whatever. Whatever the process is, I believe that direct nuclear-powered water splitting would be very efficient. It would eliminate the Carnot cycle at that point. Now, the hydrogen and oxygen then become available to an internal combustion engine, where the Carnot cycle would again be effective. But at least we haven't had to use a Carnot cycle to produce the water split in the first place. Right now, most of the hydrogen that's produced industrially is produced by stripping the carbon off of methane and leaving just the hydrogen. I should say stripping the hydrogen off and leaving the carbon as it goes away in the form of carbon dioxide. So that's a chemical process that produces the liquid hydrogen. It's a rather interesting and complicated process, but it involves having to generate the heat and do all this stuff, and there's a lot of pumping, of course, involved. But a direct conversion would be certainly a lot more efficient. Now, some of the hydrogen industry early on operated on electrolysis. But electrolysis is a very expensive process compared to stripping natural gas. The electrolysis process involves buying electric power, which had been produced by a Carnot cycle, and then using that to dissociate the water so it can go through another Carnot cycle. And so by water splitting around the Carnot cycle, you gain some performance. That is efficiency.
Now, you mentioned something very interesting to me, a patent that you discovered apparently while researching for your own patents.
When we hired our search from a patent attorney who ran the search, he delivered to us a package of several, I think about 30 patents. I don't remember exact package. But one of them was an invention by Hummer, the current name Hummer, by the way. Hummer was an automobile manufacturer in essence, but in 1900 they were granted a patent for an automobile engine system which would burn hydrogen and oxygen to run a generator which would split water to produce the hydrogen and oxygen to run the engine and have enough power left over to run the automobile. Now that's a perpetual motion machine.
So we're talking basically about a hybrid car where you have, instead of a battery pack to run the electric motors, like on a Toyota Prius, you have a gas engine running a generator, and that generator is performing electrolysis and providing fuel for itself and for the engine that runs the car?
That's right. In other words, it would produce more energy than it takes in.
It would produce enough energy for itself to generate electricity and also fuel for the engine that drives the car.
It doesn't work.
But it was an auto manufacturer in England that actually secured this patent.
Yes. Hummer, H-U-M-M-E-R, was an automobile manufacturer. And they, as far as I know, they were still building automobiles in the 50s. I don't know if the company as such still exists or not.
Now, how is it that a legitimate company that's producing automobiles would secure a fraudulent patent in 1900?
They didn't know it was fraudulent. I don't think any of these guys that do this would deliberately file for a fraudulent patent. I think they just did not understand the underlying energy concept. So I don't ascribe fraud to that patent. I ascribe in ignorance or incompetence, but not fraud.
But you took note of the fact that in every decade following that,
every two decades,
there were
1900, 1920, 1940, and 1960, there were patents issued. I'm not sure about 1960. I think so, but I don't remember for sure. But I did see the ones for 20 and 40, and because the life of a patent is about 17 years, and the prosecution time is about 3 years. So about as fast as a repeating patent could be granted. Again, it shouldn't happen, but it does. The examiners tend to be rather generous in allowing a patent to issue in spite of the existence of prior art. I think the prior art exclusion process is weak.
Yes. Yeah, I believe you're right on that. Now, let's talk about something else. You mentioned that a spark plug does not actually ignite the fuel by the spark, but rather by the light that it emits.
That's correct.
And this can be proven, you said, by installing perhaps
a university of it's an academic institution in Florida that engages in engineering studies. And those people were able to prove that the light that's emitted by a spark plug is what causes, allows the combustion process to take place. And it does it by breaking up the O2 molecule into radical oxygen. That is just O1, if you want to call it. In other words, it's monatomic oxygen. The monatomic oxygen is the second most reactive substance in the entire chemical structure. The only one that's stronger is atomic fluorine. And atomic oxygen is much more violent in its chemical reactions than even diatomic chlorine gas. And by the way, an ordinary person can produce monatomic oxygen in their kitchen just by mixing some cleanser with water. But because that's why the cleansers work, because they produce radical oxygen.
You mean a cleanser like Ajax or something?
Ajax or whatever, the old Dutch cleanser or whatever.
Yeah.
Comet and all those work by releasing basic oxygen, that is O1, if you want to call it that.
In other words, if you were to stick your nose above a pile of Comet mixed with water, you would be breathing monatomic oxygen?
Yes. Now, the half-life of monatomic oxygen is about a half a second, which means it doesn't last very long because the two atoms combine again very quickly. But because they're so reactive, they also combine quickly. But it would be fatal to breathe very much of that stuff. I guarantee that. It's worse than ozone.
Hmm.
But it has such a short half-life, and upon contact with water, it basically combines even more rapidly. So it's probably not even terribly dangerous. But in any case, there's enough atoms of pure O to attack the hydrocarbons. The hydrocarbons turned out to be very noble chemically. A lot of them don't even react to acids, although if you mix acid in some hydrocarbons, you produce esters and things of that sort. But For the most part, the hydrocarbons are relatively noble. They're not easy to ignite. And that's why the spark plug works, because it does attack some of the hydrocarbons. And then when the hydrocarbon does burn, it emits some more of the light, which causes the rest of the hydrocarbon to light off. And
okay, so you're saying that the O2 molecule is stretched like a dumbbell, like the shape of a dumbbell?
Imagine it's a dumbbell to start with, and you can either stretch it apart or you can twist it apart. And one frequency twists it, and the other frequency pulls it apart. And there are two frequencies of this light that work. Either one or both will work. And the University of one of these academic institutions in Florida, the one in Cable Gore,
Coral Gables?
Coral Gables. I got my tongue twisted there. And Coral Gables did the work that showed that. They did it by putting a diamond window in place of the spark plug and having the spark plug actually outside the engine. And the light went through the diamond window and ignited the gasoline.
Isn't that amazing?
By the way, those diamond windows cost about $35 for 1,000. So they're not very expensive.
Huh. I wonder where you'd find one.
Diamond merchants have them. You can buy them from diamond merchants.
And
that price
to me
that I
why
quoted was
diamond.
A 1973 price. I don't know what the price is today, but these are very small diamonds, just big enough to allow enough light to get into the cylinder.
And you're saying that diamond is necessary because something like glass wouldn't allow the light to pass?
As far as I know, diamond was the only material that was sufficiently transparent to these two light frequencies to allow it to get inside. Most laymen are not aware of the opacity of many substances. For instance, glass is opaque to all this light. It's just as if you had a piece of steel there.
Huh.
And so on. I mean, that's just the way the world is. We see an octave of electromagnetic radiation when we look at something. Our eyes have about an octave of frequencies that it responds to, from the red, the low frequency end, up to the purple side, which is the high frequency end. And we only see over one octave. And many substances are transparent to the light that we see, but ordinary window glass, for instance, is opaque to infrared and ultraviolet. Some of the ultraviolets don't get through. It depends on what you're looking at. A piece of plywood is transparent to infrared, but a piece of glass is not. So it's
very interesting.
Depends on what kind of electromagnetic radiation you're looking at or with.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, that's another interesting branch of science that is interesting.
Yeah, well, there's something else that you mentioned as well, and that had to do with the isomer.
I didn't finish that particular concept, but during our research days, we stumbled across some work that was being done then in Lancaster, and I understand you found a site in San Diego County, possibly the same party, that was claiming to have found a substance which would dissociate water. It was an amalgam of course, mercury and some of the other metals, so-called base metals, tin, antimony, bismuth, I don't know what all he had. He had quite a few of them. And his claim was that by pumping water into this alloy, that hydrogen gas would be evolved from it. Now, I never actually saw it happen. I had a good friend that went out and visited the man and wasn't able to get any evidence that it was actually happening. But he was working in this area and seemed to be, wildly enthusiastic about what his thing could do. And we never physically saw it and never heard of it actually coming through, but I developed a theory that might explain it. And I was starting to do that when we ran out of time the other night. But basically, most elements have different isotopes. Even hydrogen has three isotopes. The one that we normally drink, our hydrogen that we used, is primarily a substance called protium. That is, you break the hydrogen down into three kinds. There's the isotope that has one proton in the nucleus, lone proton. Then there's an isotope called deuterium or heavy hydrogen, which has one proton and one neutron added to it. The neutron doesn't contribute anything electrically, but it makes the atom heavier, hence it's called heavy hydrogen, or if it's in the form of water, it's called heavy water. Then there's a third form called tritium, which has a proton and two nuclei in the nucleus. And those are called isomers, similar to the chemical term isomer, which refers to different arrangements of the same atoms in a chemical. That gets onto the topic of, among other things, stereochemistry and so on, which is kind of beside the point right now. Now, these isotopes of the ordinary elements sometimes occur in isomeric sets. That is, there are two different configurations of the nucleus. Now, the nucleus has to be complicated enough that it can have more than one arrangement. But that's not too difficult. I think you can get, by the time you get up to four or five nuclear elements, then you start to have the opportunity of different arrangements. Now, some of the arrangements are not stable, so they don't exist, at least not for more than a very short period of time. But those are called nuclear isomers. Now, among the radioactive elements, there are somewhere around 17 sets of nuclear isomers. And there is one set that has three different nuclear isomers. Now, each nuclear isomer has its own half-life. And so the evidence for the existence of nuclear isomers appears in the form of a non-exponential decay function. And that was explained by hypothesizing the existence of nuclear isomers. Subsequently, direct evidence of the nuclear isomers has been produced by X-ray diffraction methods, I believe. I'm not even sure what technology is used to prove it. But they've been able to identify specific nuclear isomers among the radioactive elements. That does not mean that there aren't other nuclear isomers that are themselves stable. In other words, the unstable nuclear isomers result in our commonly accepted ideas of fusion, of which the atom bomb is a subset and nuclear power is a subset, because they're dependent upon, fission. Fission of the atoms into other daughter substances with the release of energy with them. And that's what happens when the uranium, when it fisses, it has a fissile reaction. And in the case of the atom bomb or nuclear power systems, the fission results in the production of so-called daughter elements. And sometimes those daughter elements are themselves radioactive, and energy can be recovered from them. But that's what that's about. But the evidence for the existence of nuclear isomers came about from the radioactive elements. That does not mean to say that there aren't nuclear isomers in the stable atoms. And so I concede the possibility that perhaps the reaction with the amalgams involved the release of energy between when the nuclear isomer transfers from one nuclear isomer into a lower energy level isomer. It could release enough energy to cause water splitting.
Okay.
So it's conceivable that happened. I don't know that it happened. It's just a hypothesis, a possible explanation for this process that we never saw come to fruition.
Yeah, but it's wonderful that you have an open mind to even contemplate a theory to explain it.
The danger of having an open mind is the distinction between an open mind and a hole in the head. So, and in any case, I just suggested that. Now, there's an interesting concept. Energy, of course, occurs in many different forms. It's weird. I mean, it's not like the concrete concepts of atoms and molecules and, you know, nuclear particles and things like that, but energy occurs in so many different forms. And one of the forms is elasticity. If you stretch a rubber band or wind up a clock spring or bend an automobile suspension spring, you're storing energy in the mechanics of the metal. The bending of the metal, the energy is now converted into the stress in the metal, and you can get it back by releasing the spring. And I think it's important that I told my physics students that a wound-up alarm clock contains more mass than one that is not wound up, because E equals mc squared. So if you have put energy into the spring, it has had to have its mass increased. And I think that's a concept that needs to be taught more, even in our lower scientific education systems. Well, the amount of energy that can be stored elastically in materials is very small, relatively speaking. You can bend a piece of metal, or you can compress a gas, or bend a mineral. I can't think of any other. Well, you can compress liquid. Gas, water can be compressed a little bit, and it stores an enormous amount of mechanical energy that way. But it's basically a so-called incompressible substance. It takes an enormous container to compress water very much. And, of course, the container contains more energy when you do that. So that's elastic stored energy. Then there's a form of energy where a combustion process takes place, gasoline engines, fire, wood-burning fire, whatever, welding torches. Those are all thermodynamic combustion processes that release a large amount of energy. And then there is the nuclear reaction that takes place. The atom bomb, the nuclear power plants. Now, on a mathematical scale, assigning a logarithmic scale to the elastic storage of zero, a logarithmic value of zero for elastic storage, then we have the chemical storage, and that then comes out on a logarithmic scale at about 3. In other words, 1,000 times more energy storage per unit volume. These are all very rough concepts, but it's about 10 to the third times stronger. Then you look at the nuclear reactions, and those are roughly equivalent to 10 to the ninth times as energetic as the elastic storage, and 10 to the sixth times, that is a million times stronger than the chemical reactions. And I just have a hunch that maybe these isomeric nuclear transformations take place at, say, somewhere around a logarithmic value of 6, or about 1,000 times more than ordinary combustion and 1,000 times less than nuclear reactions. But I don't know. I don't know of anybody that's even trying to exploit those. But there be energy.
What I've done, as we discussed, I sent you a copy of my book, and it's accompanied by a DVD that has an interview with a Tennessee rocket scientist. He was sort of a country boy. He didn't have a PhD.
I don't either. I have a Bachelor of Electrical Engineering.
Well, that doesn't keep people from making wonderful discoveries. And what Herman Anderson proposed and actually did was to direct the radiation from a spark gap, a high voltage discharge, corona discharge, into a chamber of where electrolysis was taking place.
Okay. And electrolysis or water splitting?
I'm sorry?
You see, you were directing the energy into a chamber where electrolysis or just plain water splitting? Was there electric energy involved?
Yeah, there's electrolysis taking place inside the chamber, and then you're directing the energy from this plasma arc into the chamber.
Okay.
And I'd like you to look over that DVD, and maybe we can do a follow-up interview to see what your take is on his process.
I would like to see that. I'll get it, obviously. So I will be glad to look at that. That's a new branch of science I'm not aware of. By the way, I'd like to relate a rather short episode. I mentioned in 1938, my dad took me to a lecture at Ohio State University, which was about a mile and a half from where we then lived. And I sat before one of those scientists that explained what the atom bomb could do. This was in 1938, I think.
Now, obviously, you're a young child then.
I was 7 years old. And after the lecture, they took us on a tour of the cyclotron laboratory in the Department of Electrical Engineering at Ohio State University. And I remember seeing the cyclotron and holding a screwdriver in the magnetic field. And at the same time, they were running some cryogenic work in the same laboratory, so I got to see some liquid air. Now, this is all, I was 7 years old, but that kind of set a tone, so to speak, and I just became even more interested in science. But this this lecture where this man stood up in the lecture hall at Ohio State University, in the main chemistry lecture hall, and drew a picture of Germany, and he said, you know, one of these bombs would destroy Berlin. And, you know, we just walked away from that, and I was kind of amazed and amused by it. I didn't think too much about it a whole lot. Well, then my dad was called up to active duty and went to India and built air bases in India and came back to the United States in 1944, and we joined him in Santa Ana, California. And I went to school in Santa Ana, California for the ninth grade. And then that summer in 45, I got up one morning and went out and picked up the LA Times and brought it in and said, Dad, they did it. And I held up the headline that says, Atom Bomb Hits Japan. And I knew what it was all about, and we did. And I went to school that day, and everybody's talking, what's an atom bomb, you know? And I explained it to them. And my teacher said, how did I, just a little kid, know that much about the atom bomb?
That is amazing.
And that's that was a very moving experience. And by the way, I had a kind of a recitative of that when I visited Nagasaki in Japan late in the 20th century and went to Ground Zero. And it was quite an emotional experience to see that whole concept. But those are just the things that happened. Obviously, the Atomic Energy Commission came up and suppressed any kind of thing like that at all, so that the world wasn't, at least the United States, was not aware of even the bare possibility of that happening. And yet I was, because I had been to that lecture. Of course, obviously, the people that were at that lecture with me also were aware of it.
Yeah, I wonder how many other universities had similar lectures at that same time.
I presume it was like a Chautauqua, like these professors were going around and making money giving these lectures. Now, as I say, it was one of those three, the original, the three guys that did so much together, and their names just happened to be Alpha, Beta, and Gamov.
Huh.
Equivalent to the Alpha, Beta, Gamma of the Greek
alphabet.
Isn't
that amazing?
And then, of course, as you know, in the Manhattan Project, they brought Niels Bohr over from, they extracted him from Denmark. And that's an amazing story by itself. Niels Bohr was working for the Carlsberg Brewery Laboratories. And when Germany occupied Denmark, they left the brewery running for obvious reasons. And they didn't pay any attention to what was going on in the laboratory. Well, Niels Bohr was in there contemplating the atom bomb.
Amazing.
And the underground got him out and brought him over to the United States, and he was a very strong leader in the development of the atom bomb and the Manhattan Project.
Isn't that something?
But it's just all this stuff. It's just the history that I got to see myself is very impressive to me. I mean, I think about seeing the Depression. I remember the Depression. I remember seeing people living their lives in the Depression. My dad was having a hard time, as it was. And I remember seeing at a railroad crossing a train going through with a coal car train going through this intersection, and there was a black man up on the top of the cars, walking along the cars and picking up lumps of coal and throwing them off the car to his kids, who put them in the trunk of their car so he could go home and have heat that night.
Isn't that something?
And the railroads just didn't pay attention to that. They understood this guy needs the fuel, so they didn't worry about it.
How do you like that?
And that's
now,
the way
speaking
life
of,
was an expression. And here
pressing
I
financial spoke. Needs.
I beg your pardon?
We have many people in the U.S. right now who have pressing financial needs.
Well, I'm deeply bound up myself.
Okay, and so among our listeners may be someone who'd like to give you a job. So if someone were interested in
hiring
you,
wants to give me a job and this doesn't involve too much travel, I'll be glad to do it. Now, I did spend a lot of my career traveling, but I do need to take care of my wife, so it has to be something that will allow that to happen.
Well, I'm sure it could even be done from your home with a computer.
If I can work on a computer, I've got computing capability.
So how would you like someone to get a hold of you? Do you have an email address you could give? Or?
I do. My email address is the letters P-E, referring to my initial, Patrick, and my wife's initial, Emily. So it's P-E, then a hyphen, not an underscore, but a hyphen, Underwood, UNDERWOOD, @att.net.
Okay. And they can contact Mr. Patrick Underwood about any kind of scientific consultation. And if they want to hire a a railroad consultant, history consultant, that would also be a possibility.
Now my railway history is weak. I'm not.
Okay.
I was much more interested in the technology of streetcars and, you know, getting them up and running and doing that sort of thing, although I'd spent a lot of time just riding around town and doing stuff like that. A little unusual in that regard, but we had a lot of fun doing it, and that's how I got into that. So
yeah, that's a neat historian.
I myself as a railway historian.
Well, I look forward to going by the Paris, or what is it called, the Orange Empire?
It's now called the Orange Empire Railway Museum.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to going by there and seeing that someday.
Now, it's open to the public on the weekends especially. They do run the streetcars every weekend, and on alternate weekends they run the steam engine. They have a steam engine called Ventura County Number 2, and it's a steam engine that was run by the Ventura County Railway back, I think, primarily in the sugar days, but I'm not even sure what its history was. But that engine has recently been refurbished for a cost of somewhere around $100,000 to get it up and running for a few years. The federal regulations on those have become very severe. But it does run, and occasionally it ventures off onto the branch line there, the Santa Fe, what used to be the Santa Fe branch line. It's now owned by the county. That's the line that runs from Riverside through Paris, Winchester, Hemet, and ends up in San Jacinto.
Well, Mr. Underwood, it's been a real pleasure to have you as a guest on the program, and I'm looking forward to doing a follow-up interview and getting your take on.
Well, I very much appreciate your interest, and again, I refer to the four people that the other three of us that worked together on it, that we were dedicated to the interest of the environment pretty much more than anything else.
Yeah, and that's very commendable. Okay, well, I hope you have a good day, and we'll look forward to getting with you again.
Oh, okay, well, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.